Coming up next, This Week in Computer Hardware, Radeon RX 5500 XT might be the $200 GPU. Intel's new process roadmap is ridiculous. The new Mac Pro, AMD's Adrenaline 2020, and more coming up next on Twitch.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 544, recorded on December 12th, 2019. The 1080p GPU to beat. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you all the hardware news, the good, the bad, the ugly, the mobile, the handheld, the console. But this week, we got a lot of desktop, including some spectacular promises from Intel, new GPUs from our friends at AMD, and a whole lot of Mac Pro. Oh, my goodness. Sebastian Peake joins me as always. I'm Patrick Norton, by the way, in case I didn't mention that. Sebastian, you are in Benchmarking Central for PC Purr. You have bled on the RX 550, the latest AMD Radeon. You titled the article, Navi Attacks the Mainstream. I feel like this hints that this is an affordable card.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is... this is basically their replacement for that price point that we've been used to from them, that sort of $200 range part from the RX 480 up to the 580. And then we've been, for a while now, we've gotten used to seeing their RX 590 selling at around that $200 price point. And here's another card that's $200 for a desktop GPU that's targeting 1080p performance for an 8 gigabyte version, but they're also offering a 4 gigabyte version. Basically, you know, if you're targeting 1080p, you don't necessarily need all that extra video memory, depending on what you're doing, what game you're playing. So then they have this cheaper variant, which is only $169. And it pretty much goes head-to-head against the GTX 1650 Super, though that card is $10 cheaper. So that's the backstory for this launch. NVIDIA obviously knew this was coming. AMD had released to OEMs this Radeon RX 5500 product. It turned out that was indeed an OEM only product. They'd said something about it coming to desktop in December when we were first briefed about it. Well, here it is. And the desktop version is actually called the RX 5500 XT. And when I first heard that, I'm thinking, oh, so this is like, what are the specs? What is this? What differentiates this from the OEM version? And really, it's just clock speeds. The XT is faster. it's the same GPU. It's the new Navi 14.
Right.
Not to be confused with 14 nanometer. This is still a 7 nanometer part. It's still the new RDNA architecture. We just got Navi 10 or Navi 10 first. That was with the RX 5700 series. And now we have Navi 14. And this is the same chip they're using for their 5500M mobile parts, like what we find in the new MacBook Pro 16 that we talk about every week, it seems. And so it's 22 compute units, 1,408 shaders, 88 texture units, and 32 ROPs. And it's using really fast GDDR6 memory. This is 14 gigabit per second memory. And like I said, a 4 gigabyte and an 8 gigabyte version are going to be available. In fact, they are available. What I was sent by AMD was a partner card. So this is a partner-only launch. Companies like XFX and Sapphire and Asus and the rest are going to have their own products for these. AMD doesn't have their own reference card. That was kind of the OEM-only market for those. So we got this nice Nitro Pulse card from Sapphire, which is one of those dual-fan aftermarket cards. And I ran it through some benchmarks at 1080p using high settings to see how it compared against other like sub $250 cards. And if you look at the performance numbers, it's basically it loses to the RX 590 in most of the tests by a very small margin. And it's faster than the GTX 1650 Super by a small margin. So it's right in between those two cards. And the 1650 Super starts at 159. This one's 169. I tested the 4 gigabyte model. And then that older RX 590 has been selling for about 199. So it's a good value, and it's a little surprising to me, I guess, that they wouldn't release a product that could best their existing mainstream 1080p graphics card at the $200 price point. But when I saw the pricing, it kind of made sense. They're just sort of replacing it. It's almost as fast as an RX 590 in games like the ones I tested, where you're not really pushing things. I think you'd have more of an advantage the higher up you went. And that RX 590 gives you some like 1440p gaming capability. It has more memory than this card. So you'd a better comparison of that, we'll have to wait until I have an 8 gigabyte card to test. But as it stands, it importantly does beat NVIDIA's product in this segment because it's faster than the GTX 1650 Super. It is also $10 more. So that's, we're getting into that. We've been talking about this all year. Every $10, there's another GPU option. And it has been sort of an NVIDIA partner issue, where it's not really an issue for them, but they're clogging up the market with graphics cards at every single $10 price point, from $150 to $500. And then this just kind of complicates things, because for $10 more than an NVIDIA product, you can get an AMD product, and it's providing you just a little bit more performance. Not big gains, but, you know, I think I had a little tally here. It was plus 1.5% in Red Dead Redemption 2, so not a huge gain there. Plus 7.5% in Metro Exodus, plus almost 4% in Far Cry 5. It only lost to NVIDIA in the one older benchmark I ran, which is the World of Tanks Encore. Not really an old benchmark, but just not very taxing. And that's those benchmarks tend to lean a little bit more towards the NVIDIA cards, and even the Pascal generation of NVIDIA cards do quite well. The 1060 6 gigabyte beat it out in that test, but just a quick look at performance there, but it just validated what I expected, which was, based on these specs, it would be just a little bit faster than NVIDIA's card. And I don't know, I think it's kind of interesting that at this point, if NVIDIA is concerned that they're not leading the charts at 1080p in this 160 to 170 range, it could force them to lower the price a little bit. If we see another $10 price drop, that would place the 1650 Super right at 150, where the original 1650 launched. And it, just in case you haven't or have forgotten, the 1650, the GTX 1650, which launched this year, is about, you know, 30-40% slower than these cards. For like $10 or $20 more, you're getting so much more card that, to me, it doesn't really make sense to keep the 1650 around. It's at the bottom of every chart. It's at the bottom of the four charts in my review here. And it's just sitting there at $149 for pretty anemic performance compared to even older products like the 1060. So I would love to see NVIDIA just discontinue that. Slot the 1650 Super in right at that 149 price point. And then they could say, hey, we have the 1080p champion because our card is $20 less than AMD's card, and that would force AMD to drop their price. So I'm just seeing these 1080p price wars starting. At least that's what I'm hoping for. And it's it's kind of exciting. It took us all year, but we're finally to the point where both companies have filled out the sort of mid-range and entry-level mainstream graphics card segments, and things are starting to become more competitive, and now they're going to have to start competing with each other on price. We've already seen some $10 price drops on NVIDIA cards. The 1660 is now selling for $199 with like $10 discount codes, and I'm sure we'll see a price drop so that it will match the price of that 8 gigabyte variant of this new Radeon card. So hence the Star Wars puns in our coverage of this. Begun
so many
the
Star Wars puns.
Wars have. Yes.
Well, so okay, so it seems like if you have 200, maybe $220, depending on which you know card or bundle you're buying, because I'm seeing, you know, they're all over Newegg. It seems like this is the 1080p card if you don't plan on upgrading your monitor anytime soon. I mean, I think that's the simple takeaway on this one.
Yeah, it does get, I won't go too far down the rabbit hole, but it does get complicated. If you are willing to go to 200, 220, suddenly the 1660 Super sitting there at 229 becomes a much better buy, because it was right. Just like the vanilla 1650 will always be at the bottom of all of these charts. The 1660 Super is at the top, and it's got a pretty big lead for that $30 additional investment. So until we can test an 8 gigabyte card, I can't say that the amount of frame buffer is really going to change anything for this GPU from AMD, because we were intentionally testing at settings that didn't exceed the 4 gigabyte limit.
Right. So because I like watching you have that pained facial expression, I'm going to say, given this is mostly 1080p testing, 8 gigabytes shouldn't help it that much. Sometimes we're surprised.
Sometimes we are surprised, and I really think that 6 gigabyte total that NVIDIA has with the 1660 and up is kind of the sweet spot for 1080p, because you can do 1080p Ultra. Games like Far Cry 5, for example, I've been using that all year. If you enable the HD textures, which are just like downloadable content for free, makes the game look a little bit better. Even at 1080, if you enable those, you are at about 4.25 gigabytes, and you'll start running into issues if you're using a 4 gigabyte card. So you have to dial it back. You can play with it. You could do ultra settings without HD textures, and you're still going somewhere between 3 and 4 gigs. And there are other games that are very memory intensive as well. Metro Exodus is a very, very demanding benchmark, and Red Dead Redemption 2 as well. Like, these are not games where you're just going to plug anything in and get 60 frames per second. You've got to really manage your settings in this sort of, 200 and under price segment. So having extra memory does give you more options as far as some of the things you can enable in the game. And, you can go back and forth on resolution and textures and stuff, but for the most part, 4 gigabytes is not a huge limiting factor.
Okay. That makes sense. New Adrenaline drivers come out. It's become the tradition at AMD to release the fantabulous new Adrenaline, interface, if nothing else, design. there is a new Adrenaline. It has been released in time for the holiday shopping season, or I guess the holiday downloading season in this case. You can actually launch games from Adrenaline now. And I'm going to quote Jeremy Hellstrom here. It also adds an AMD image sharpening in DX11 games. AMD Radeon Anti-Lag is going to support DX9 games and legacy GPUs. And they have introduced integer display scaling, a way to upscale older games to high-resolution displays without any performance cost. They've added DirectML filters to help you clean up your screenshots and pictures. You can control game streaming from inside the app. And Radeon Boost can be enabled to automatically downscale resolution during fast motion-based camera movement to improve performance. And AMD Link has been significantly updated. And you can do a whole lot of tweaking of settings in there for your games to the point where you really need to be careful what you have checked, or you will drive yourself insane. This seems like a natural download immediately.
Yeah, there's no downside to this. I had to use it for this review, and obviously the launch today also includes support for that 5500 XT. But when we were being briefed on this, the only thing I cared about was the integer scaling. As soon as Scott Wasson, who now works for AMD, he used to be the editor-in-chief at Tech Report, as soon as he mentioned integer scaling, I'm like screaming into the chat like, yes, integer scaling, and he was laughing. And like, to me, that's a huge deal, because that was a big differentiation point that NVIDIA had. We've been teased with integer scaling by Intel with Gen 11 graphics, which are not widely available at this point. NVIDIA decided to put them into their drivers earlier this year, and we were left without any if you were running a Radeon card. So, and if you're not familiar, integer scaling is literally just basically pixel doubling until you run out of screen real estate. Like, you'll end up with maybe some black borders, but you'll have something that looks really, really sharp and crisp. And depending on your monitor resolution, you may even get it to fill the entire screen and look really crisp. But I briefly played with the integer scaling in this new driver, and it's just night and day to me, because it goes from kind of blurry looking interpolated scaling if you're playing a game at a lower resolution than your monitor natively supports,
right?
Which is a great way to get better performance out of a game. Then all of a sudden, you can do that, and it still looks great. So this, to me, is the killer feature, and everybody should update and definitely at least check out the integer scaling option. It's an easy checkbox in your global settings with this software, which is very polished at this point. AMD software has been getting better and better over the last couple of years, and it's gotten to the point where it's just like, click here, okay, check this box. You're not drilling down through, you know, tabs in a very old-looking interface like the old days. So it's right. Very nice.
Oh, my goodness. Keep your pixel art crisp, people. download Adrenaline 2020. No hardware podcast this week could be complete without mentioning the new Mac Pro. And I actually like the case design on this. Some people have called it a cheese grater. And if it's a cheese grater, it is a sophisticated Italian or, you know, Norwegian, or it's a massive, interesting, kind of crazy design, because it is designed to move a whole lot of air through there while making the least annoying noise possible. More on that in a second. It is big. It is massive. It allows access on all four sides. It is $6,000 to $53,000. No, seriously.
He said 53,000. That is actually correct.
And it starts to make sense once you see what you get for 53,000. Although I have not mathed out what it would take to build a Hackintosh like this. And also, please, Sebastian, no $400 wheel jokes.
I was going to go there with the
$1,000 monitor stand.
Yeah. Forgetting all that, just looking at the practical side, I went to Server right. Supply before the show and was just trying to price out the modules they're using, because they're using DDR4 2933 right. server memory in 128 gigabyte DIMMs. And right. those start at $1,500 each if you're buying it from a place like that, where you can get like a small discount for buying in quantity. And that's really expensive. And that $53,000 configuration, I played around with this yesterday.
$52,600.
Yeah. That's insane until you look at the fact that $25,000 of that price was just the 1.5 terabyte memory.
And upgrade. There's 12 of them, you know.
Yeah, 12 of those.
Yeah, 12 1.5 terabyte DDR4 ECC RAM. And, you know, one of the things when I look at this, one of the conversations I got into talking about building up video editing workstations a year or two ago was the simple fact that, do you or do you not actually need Xeon processors? And for the vast majority of us, I think the answer is no. That said, you know, these are, you know, in that $52,600 version, it's a 2.5 gigahertz, 28 core Intel Xeon W processor, you know, 1.5 terabytes of DDR4 ECC RAM. That's 12 128 gigabyte sticks, pardon me. Dual Radeon Pro Vega 2 Duos, with each has 32 gigs of HBM2 memory. That's 4 terabytes of SSD storage, which is probably the smallest upgrade on that list price-wise. 8 terabytes is TBA. They haven't started selling those yet. You can spend a lot of money on this. I thought it was really interesting. Apple, so for example, like a lot of the traditional Mac reviewers didn't get one of these. Apple ceded machines to YouTubers, included Marcus Brownlee, iJustine, and Jonathan Morrison. I really admire Marcus Brownlee's works. His videos are fantastic, and he actually pays attention to performance. He took a look at transcoding and exporting 8K Red clips in his unboxing and second impressions video. So what took 20 minutes, and none of this is a shock, right? As you spend more money, things get faster. But what took 20 minutes on his MacBook Pro takes 11 minutes and 56 seconds on his iMac Pro, and takes 4 minutes and 20 seconds on the Mac Pro that Apple provided him with. Now, and that's without the Afterburner server processing card, because of the type of video he's running, the 8K Red video. Now, the configuration he's got is a $32,000, $200 machine with 384 gigabytes of RAM. You know, he's got a full review coming. And one of the things he points out is, this is not, you know, what this does is, by giving him more time, or by taking less time to run iterations, he can experiment more as a creator. Is this necessary? Probably not. Does it open up opportunities for him as a creator? Absolutely. Are a lot of people going to spend $52,600 or even the more modest $32,200 on these machines? Probably not if you're not a professional, and maybe not even then. You know, can you get a lot of this performance out of an AMD, you know, Ryzen powered system? To a point, and that point is when you start getting governed on the amount of memory you can use. To, for example, if you're shuffling around massive 8K clips, that's when having staggering amounts of memory becomes something that radically impacts your performance. So interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. Also, a really good article on Popular Mechanics talked about the thermodynamics behind the Mac Pro, quote, the hypercar of computers. And I kind of mentally subtitled this, cool fans are cool. Popular Mechanics interviewed Chris Lightenberg, the senior director of product design at Apple. And he starts out by talking about what they started doing years ago, which is changing the distribution of the blades on the fans. So the fan is balanced, but they get randomized, quote, in terms of their BPF or blade pass frequency. And that what that does is actually eliminate harmonics. Now, you actually can see that if you have, you know, if you can get to the fan inside your car and your car is less than 20 years old, you can probably see that, or maybe even less than 30 years old. What gets really crazy is, you know, that eliminates or minimizes harmonics that are annoying. I love he points out that, quote, that solution is almost borrowed entirely from automobile tires. There's a bit of math behind it, but you can create broadband noise instead of total noise with that technique. And the idea is to substitute more pleasing noises for more annoying noises in terms of whatever noise the fans inside of this system make. And there's four fans inside of the system, three in the front, one in the back. I thought it was interesting, an interesting read, because it's, you know, do I need to spend $6,000 for a desktop? Absolutely not. Is it neat to see how kind of like down the rabbit hole the designs get on these? Absolutely. Plus nerding out on fan design fascinates me because I have hardware issues. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Z490 motherboards for 10th gen Comet Lake S CPUs. They're here now, right?
Not quite, no. But they will be coming. I think they said the rumor currently is around April of next year, so early next year. It's interesting that while there is not going to be 10 nanometer desktop right away next year, if at all, mm-hmm. with the move to these higher core counts that we'd heard rumored, Intel moving to a 10 core i7 mainstream processor part, for example, and adding hyper-threading to all the Core i5 products and just basically answering the challenge from AMD with the Ryzen products by just increasing core counts and improving things where they can within the same architecture, they're going to do this with a new platform. So it's kind of interesting. On the one hand, yeah, you usually expect a new platform with a new Intel CPU, but at the same time, if it's the same architecture and if it's the same physical pinout, then why do you really need a new chipset? But okay, just to annoy you, know, they sell chipsets too. They make money on that chipset business, so that could be part of it. But yeah, I'm more looking forward to those higher core counts just being standard. So if you are on an Intel platform, laptop or desktop in 2020, it's looking more and more like, you know, 6 cores with hyper threading is going to become the norm. 8 cores hyper threaded. 10 core 20 thread parts at the top, where we currently have products like the 9700K, which is an 8 core non hyper threaded part at around 350, 370 range, and then up to that $500 range with the 9900K, which is again just 8 cores, but that one does have hyper threading. So I like the part of that article I enjoyed was just the chart they put together, the table that has the part numbers and the core counts. So it is looking more and more like, and we're getting this from more and more sources now, more cores and more threads next year.
More cores, more threads, more joy. We were talking about this in pre-show, and I was shocked, I'll say, that at the aggressive nature of Intel's manufacturing roadmap, i.e. the process technology they plan to hit between 2019 and 2029. It was a nice write-up by Dr. Ian Cutress up on Nantech. And you were actually talking about some other articles about this. There was a slide that ASML, one of Intel's partners, showed at the IEDM conference, the International Electron Devices Meeting, talking about process node technologies. And Intel's looking aggressive. You know, backporting 7 nanometer, 5 nanometer, 3 nanometer, 2 nanometer, and 1.4 nanometer by 2029. And my response is, wait, what? You know, aren't they several years behind on their process plan now? But Dr. Cutress writes, Intel expects to be on a two-year cadence with its manufacturing process node technology, starting with 10 nanometer in 2019, moving to 7 nanometer EUV in 2021, then a fundamental new node in each of 2023, 2025, 2027, and 2029. The final node is what ASML has dubbed 1.4 nanometer. This is the first mention of 1.4 nanometer in the context of Intel on any Intel-related slide. For context, if that 1.4 nanometer is indicative of any actual feature, it would be the equivalent of 12 silicon atoms across, which is tiny and is going to have fascinating issues with heating and cooling. And I'm curious and excited and completely, completely in disbelief that Intel can hit 7 nanometer in 2021, much less 1.4 nanometer in 2029. So I asked you, I was like, you know, I'm not reading about any secret sauce or that Intel's cracked the problem that's kept them from delivering any of a number of processes they've been trying to deliver for the last several years. What's your take?
I don't believe it. So, I mean, it's nice for them to have goals. We all need goals. One of the things they teach you if you take management courses is to set achievable goals for people and hold them accountable to them. But still, you have to make measurable, right, achievable goals in business. And this just looks like they're throwing out a slide. It says, in more we trust. And, you know, it's Gordon Moore, co-founder of Intel, and Moore's Law isn't dead. And look, guys, we're going to be aggressive now. We're going to double down. And all we've been hearing for the last 2 years is all of the trouble they've had just getting off of 14 nanometer, which and it isn't getting any better anytime soon. Like we're at the end of 2019, and there are a few Ice Lake parts out there. It never made it into desktop. It's not in server. And at this point, they're doing things like increasing the TDPs of server products to increase the clock frequencies and thus increase the performance, because AMD with their EPYC products is throwing like 64 cores at people. And AMD or Intel only had 40 to 48 cores total available. So
right,
it's an interesting time. And we'll see if they can deliver on this. But I look at these goals they have. And from 2017 to 2019, it's not been a good 2 years for them. We're still on the same architecture that we have been. And I find it a little hard to believe that they could be as aggressive as this. Now, of course, this is a slide that they're showing. This is like a partner showing a slide. It's not Intel coming out publicly and stating, like, this is what we're going to do. So I'm just kind of curious. Like, if this is something that they were proudly talking about, they were briefing media about, and they had a page up on their website about it, they'd be held a lot more accountable to this. Remember, this is a publicly traded company. If they are not able to deliver on promises like this, it's only going to hurt their business. So... But what's going to hurt more in the interim is if they can't get onto a new architecture quickly, then, you know, there are these upgrade cycles that are going to have to happen. There are customers who are waiting on products. They are even having trouble delivering 14 nanometer. We've talked about all the delays. That's been a story all year long. So I have mentioned on this podcast a little facetiously a couple times this year that I think it's time for them to get out of the fab business, maybe spin that off and then work on their designs and work with partners.
Right.
Something that AMD did a very long time ago when they just didn't have the money to accommodate all of their businesses at that time, and they spun off their foundry and it became Global Foundries. But I don't know. Intel with their own foundry has not been able to transition off of 14 nanometer yet. And it's been a multi-year journey for them. I just find it very hard to look ahead and see a roadmap this aggressive, where they're on to 7 nanometer EUV in 2021. And then, you know, who knows what the future holds, but 1.4 nanometers by 2029 with new features. Like, okay, I mean, it looks nice on a chart, but it seems a little bit crazy. I was thinking about this because just a couple days ago, our Josh Walrath, who's been a long time editor for us here at PC Per, he did an interview with Kevin Crewell, who was an engineer at AMD way back in the day, back in the K6, going into the K7 right. era. And he was talking about, because he spent time as, he's an analyst now, he spent time at different companies. He was talking about an analyst meeting with Intel years ago in the Pentium 4 era, where they were doing something like this. They were showing slides, and it's like, we're at 4 gigahertz now. We're going to be at 6 gigahertz by, I think it was in 2 years. And he just sat there and said, no, you're not. You're like, oh, yes, we are. No, you're not. You're not going to be at 6 gigahertz in 2 years. And of course they weren't, but it was something to tell the analysts in the room, and they had projected it out. Right. And of course they abandoned that architecture, but maybe they could have something in these timeframes. I think the issue right now with 10 nanometer isn't that they can't do it. It's that they couldn't do it at a high enough performance level for it to make any sense, because they would be releasing a product at lower clock speeds without enough of an IPC edge to mitigate that. And then you'd basically just be dealing with, well, it's lower power, but it's also lower performance. And that doesn't make any sense for desktop. And it's very specific if that would make any sense on the server side, where, yes, energy costs are a huge part of the deal. It's the total cost. But that's where Epic is offering such a great solution. So, the short answer is I don't believe it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. In other news that's interesting to contemplate, Apple supplier Japan Display this week agreed to an $829 million, quote, cash injection. This is up in the Financial Times from Ichigo Asset Management, which is a company that invests in Japanese company looking for value. There's also another $200 million probably coming from Apple, and millions, tens of millions coming from other places. Japan Display is one of apparently two makers of iPhone 11 and Apple Watch displays. Apple is apparently 60% of the revenue of this company. So there's might explain why the $200 million is being sent their way. When we talk about display manufacturers, TV manufacturers not making much money, this is a classic example. Japan Display was pulled out of the, I will call it wreckage, but let's say the surviving bits of Sony, Toshiba, and Hitachi's display units back in 2012. When it launched, shares were selling for like 900 yen. And if you don't know what that means, just put it this way. They're down to like, as of like last week, I think they're down to like 73 yen per share, i.e. the value in this company. They haven't made a profit in 5 years. And part of that was because the iPhone XR, which was using Japan Display's liquid crystal display, basically sales were disappointing. And I'm bringing all this up, and also at the same time, right, Samsung displays got more popular, Huawei, Oppo, several other massive phone manufacturers have moved to alternative sources. And I think it's interesting because on one hand, you're looking at, okay, Apple needs a second supplier so they can maybe have room to negotiate or simply not run out of screens for phones. And on the other side, this is a classic, you were talking business management before, you know, if one company is responsible for the majority of your revenue, if they have a bad year, then you're going to have a bad year. And it's kind of crazy when you think about somebody who's a fairly heavy duty supplier for Apple, being in deep financial trouble. So it's, I thought it was an interesting article, and also it's something that, for example, on AVXL, Robert Heron and I have talked about for a while, where in terms of larger displays, it is enormously difficult to make money selling televisions. And that's something that's pretty much been a fact since Vizio drove prices down incredibly fast many, many years ago. Something to keep an eye out for. I'm kind of curious what's going to happen to the company. And also, I'm kind of curious what's going to happen as things continue to evolve on the Apple side of things and phone displays in general, to see who ends up making them, especially if we see more and more folding displays. Not that I expect to see many of those, but I am curious. Western Digital's fairly bomb-proof mobile SSDs have some competition. Tech PowerUp has a nice review of Crucial's X8 portable NVMe SSD 1 terabyte drive, which is selling for like $130 now. I've seen some of the Western Digital 1 terabyte drives selling for Extreme Drive selling in the $100 range, and I like portable SSD drives. As somebody with a 5 terabyte standard rotating drive that I use for backup in my backpack right now, I don't want to challenge the universe to crush my, you know, the drive that's in my bag right now. But generally speaking, it's amazing how well portable drives hold up when you travel with them. That said, an SSD is going to hold up a lot better under a lot more trying experiences, for lack of a better description. There are a couple challenges in this one. You can't get all of the speed out of the drive that you might want, assuming you can actually, you know, read or write fast enough to hit that, because it is running on USB 3.2 by 2, or no, it is not running at USB 3.2 by 2 at this point. They don't have any capacities larger than 1 terabyte. it's pretty impressive. If you need hardware encryption, that's not an option, but you know, a 3-year warranty, USB-C, and type A adapters are in the box. Seems to be fairly well constructed. Price is good. And, I'm happy for Crucial to have another market for their memory, and this is looking like a decent option. And you know, I also should point out that, as Tech PowerUp points out, there's not a whole lot of USB 3.2 Gen 2x2 out there, so exactly. It is something to think about. If you do move a lot of big, massive files on a regular basis, it's something to think about making sure you have support for in your next build. So
very, very few of those. And you can get some one enclosure coming, I guess, from Asus. I know that Legit Reviews had a little sneak peek of that in the last couple of weeks, where it's getting closer to the capabilities of NVMe drives. But for USB right now, you're kind of hard pressed even to find 10 gigabit per second connections. Like it's a lot of 5 drives out. Even the professional drives are stuck kind of at that USB 3.1 Gen 1 speed instead of Gen 2. Or is it 3.2 Gen 2 now? Whatever they want to call it. But
whatever they're calling it this week.
Yeah. But hey, I feel for you, Patrick, that 5 terabytes of spinning media in your backpack is, you got to take care of your bits. Those are your bits. And you got to keep them safe.
Well, it's also, and I should have mentioned, it's not a Western Digital Extreme. It's a SanDisk, which is part of Western Digital. SanDisk 1 terabyte Extreme portable external SSD. That's $170 for 1 terabyte. This was 5 terabytes for $90. It's a secondary copy. And since we haven't said it in several weeks, let's say it right now. Backing up 3, 2, 1. 3 copies on at least 2 different media, at least 1 offsite. It's not my entire universe. It just happens to be a place where I stuff large files to make sure they don't exist only on my laptop. Yeah, the SanDisk Extreme drives are really cool. Be curious to see if they announce some more of those at CES this year, but we'll find out soon. Google, this is technically not hardware news, although I do find it deeply fascinating what you can do on a phone. And admittedly, this involves a lot of communications with big giant cloud servers on the interwebs. Google just dropped interpreter real-time translation into mobile, as in like today, built into Google Assistant. So you can say, hey, help me speak Mandarin or Hindi or Spanish or any of 44 other languages. This was rolled out on the home devices a while back, and now it's actually mobile. And I find it deeply, deeply fascinating because I've had friends that have used this in places where they do not speak the language remotely. And, you know, I should say the lens. And now it's actually I'm fascinated, you know. I'm fascinated to you know, hear more about how it's working for people. And it's that much closer to the babblefish being stuffed into your ear. And if you don't know what that is, just search babblefish and it'll probably make a lot less sense. shout out to the crew over at JDS Labs. They just updated a couple weeks ago the Element and the EL DAC and the EL Amp. They have the Element 2, the JDS EL DAC 2 and the EL Amp 2. So I talked a while back about a $99 headphone amp from JDS Labs called the Atom, and the chief engineer over at JDS spent about a year experimenting with, you know, PCB layout and topology and how the parts were mounted and the thickness of the boards. And he came up with this amazing performing $99 headphone amp that actually I've seen destroy equipment or resist noise and deliver performance, resist noise better than and deliver performance equivalent to products that cost 10 times as much. That's impressive. It's plastic. It's small. They don't have a matching DAC if you need to have all of your audio components match. But it is an unbelievable piece of engineering, and it's fantastic as a headphone amp and also as a preamp. It's $99, JDSLabs.com. The Element 2 is the update of their large all-in-one headphone amp and DAC. And so they have separates, the EL DAC 2 and the EL Amp 2, that sell for $299 and $249. The Element 2 basically combines the DAC and the amp into a single box with a big black knob on the top, which I am completely in love with because it's awesome. It's a fairly flawless implementation of an AKM 4493 DAC. And some prefer a different filter roll-off. If you're the person that particularly favors this filter over that filter, you can ask them to choose it for you at the factory if you're that nerdly. But the whole amplifier design on this this headphone amp and DAC was informed by that ridiculously good $99 Atom headphone amp. U.S. made, very, very well engineered and built. I'm looking forward to picking one up, perhaps for my stocking in the holiday shopping season. It's a really nice piece of engineering. Do you need one? Probably not, unless you are a serious listener or have headphones that need serious power, or if you just like giant, shiny black knobs. And if you want to get into some seriously intense testing, fun place to look at. We've talked about Headphile out over the years. Jude over there does some great stuff, and Amir over at audioscienceReview.com, which if you're watching the video, you can see all of the fascinating testing. Because one of the things about what's going on with JDS Labs and the number of other companies out there is they are building stuff that is performing pretty much beyond what the human ear, even at its prime, can test in terms of jitter or noise or channel separation or any of a number of other features. So, you know, performance that would have cost you 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 times as much a couple 4 years ago is now way down in price. It's pretty impressive. You know, I like that. Also, US made, which is a big plus. Oh my goodness. CES is coming. If you have CES questions for us or any kind of hardware question, do us a favor. Email twitch@twit.tv. That's twitch@twit.tv. And if this is your first episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, please go over to twit.tv/twitch, and you will find all the information on how to subscribe and information, basically all of the older videos. You can go back hundreds of episodes should you so desire to. PCPer.com is the host of Sebastian Peak, or I should say the home of Sebastian Peak. He's the editor-in-chief over there. Is there anything we can tease, or at this point are you just, you know, at the end of the benchmarking marathon? Because you retested a ton of cards for that 5500 review, didn't you?
Yeah, a little half-dozen group there. It's never done. I have another Radeon card to test. It's an existing product. It's another variant of the 5700 XT. And at least one significant processor to get finally on the test bed. as of today. So that's going to occupy my time the next few days. It's kind of crazy that, you know, you get closer to the end of the year and I start to look at the backlog, like, I can get all this stuff done before the holidays, and it just never seems to stop. But yeah, they're the one big AMD processor that was missing from our last CPU review. We finally have our hands on one. So nice. We're going to start testing the 3950X and, you know, put some charts together and see how it performs and see if it's worth all the fuss firsthand. Of course, we already know what the performance is like, but it'll be good to have it in the system and start comparing products to it.
To feel the power, as it were.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Oh, my goodness. And, hey, if you have a hardware question, do us a favor, Twitch at twit.tv. We got another episode next week. We will be off the week of Christmas and then coming back the first week of January. So if you're watching the video, that's my dog Lupin in the background, who apparently has finally woken up and is apparently watching squirrels. Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, since there is no VR substitute or AR substitute for squirrel watching. Oh, I almost forgot Magic Leap. Oh, my goodness. What a mess. They were projecting 100,000 units, and the rumors that they've sold less than 6,000. They don't seem to have a killer app, and they're sort of now labeling their developer's edition, well as the consumer version, and it's still $2,300. I don't think anybody out there is looking to buy one. But if you are, don't. And I also got to say that it's kind of exciting that Oculus Quest, they're supposed to be releasing support for actual hand tracking. And developers are going to start working with that this week for an actual launch in October. So if you've been waiting for the opportunity to use your fingers in VR, it's looking like the Oculus Quest may be the first one there. So one can only imagine what this will bring to the world of VR next fall. Silence.
I don't want to imagine some of the things it might bring, but yes, putting your real fingers in a virtual environment, there's a lot of possibilities there.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.